Now you are listening to Talk of the Town.
Talk of the Town
with Ray Hanania. Talk of the Town brought to you by Life Run Medical Alert Systems.
And welcome to Talk of the Town Radio. I'm Ray Hanania here on January 2nd. It's Friday in the new year. Happy New Year to everybody. We hope you're doing well out there, that you're enjoying the good, the vibes that we have for the coming year. It's just phenomenal. Hopefully things will continue to get better for everybody, and I wish that for everyone out there. Talk of the Town Radio is broadcast live every Friday at 4 p.m. On YahalaVoice.com and 1450 AM radio. Our producer is Khalid Khilfa. And if you want to share your opinion, we want to hear it. Our telephone call-in line is 708-321-1313, extension 1. Talk of the Town Radio is brought to you by Life Run Medical Alert Systems, the best emergency room system, the best emergency system for seniors and people in healthcare need available today. We broadcast live every Friday, and we have some great guests today. We're waiting for one of them to call in, Ziad Asli from the American Task Force on Palestine. We wanted to talk to him about the UN vote on to reject the Palestinian draft resolution to recognize Palestine as a state. It's very interesting. The United States worked very hard to avoid a veto because they vetoed everything that Israel wants it to veto. But they worked very hard to prevent them from giving a veto by denying the resolution the total number of votes it needed to pass. It needed 9 votes, and I think it was 15 votes in the Security Council at the UN. They needed 9 votes to pass. They got 8 votes on the resolution, which was introduced by a member of the Security Council this year, Jordan. It included support from China, France, Russia, Luxembourg, Chad, Chile, and Argentina. Of course, voting against it is the United States and that racist country called Australia, which hates Arabs. Australia is probably one of the most anti-Arab countries in the world. It also got an abstention, which was kind of like a compromise. The United States lobbied these countries very hard to not get them to vote. There were 8 votes, remember, and if one of these would have voted for it, then the United States would have had to go on record to veto a pro-peace resolution like they always do, preventing anything that recognizes Palestinian rights from being approved in the United Nations. I mean, it's so funny how the United States bashes the United Nations all the time, but when it comes to doing something positive, it's really the United States that is issuing vetoes to prevent peace, to block Palestinian civil rights, and to reinforce Israel's occupation, oppression, and military assault on the civilians, which, by the way, this last summer in August, 2,200 Palestinian civilians were murdered by Israel's military. These are people that were, a lot of them were in their homes. 500 of those 2,200 were children under the age of 16 or under, and it included about 100 babies and infants that were killed. They basically bombed homes because they believed, or they claimed, anyway, I'm not sure if I believe them, but the Israelis claimed that there were Hamas militants, which they referred to as terrorists, in those homes. So they felt that even though there were civilians in those homes, it was okay to kill everybody in it just to get the militant. And of course, that's a big propaganda lie that governments use all the time, because you know the communists used it. The Yugoslavia, when the breakup, the Serbian government, which attacked civilians, alleged that it was, you know, it couldn't help but to kill civilians because they were being used as human shields by their enemies. So the Israelis are no different. They had no problem killing civilians, knowing that those were civilians. They killed them and using the excuse that, oh, well, you know, those 15 civilians in that home, died because Hamas was using them as human shields. Well, obviously, the human shield thing didn't work very well because throughout the entire war for 6 weeks, Israel bombed every civilian target that it alleged was being used as a human shield. So at some point, you think if, in fact, Hamas was really using civilians as human shields, they might have said, you know what, it's not working, let's come up with another strategy. Now, I don't believe they did that. I think that these are civilians resisting against Israel's oppression, and anybody who resists, according to Israel, is a member of Hamas, and anybody who resists, according to Israel, is a terrorist, and everyone who resists, according to Israel, should be killed. And that's really sad. That's a sad statement on a country that claims to be a democracy. Now, I don't blame Israel as a people. I blame the government of Israel and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is a war criminal and one of the worst extremists, fanatic extremist terrorists in the world today. He is one of the worst. And the fact, though, that Israelis are afraid to speak up against him makes me feel ashamed. Because Jewish people have always been at the forefront of civil rights. To see them kind of back down and not stand up for civil rights just because it's a country that they're so close to. And I totally get Jewish support of Israel. I get it. I understand it. And in the ultimate peace process, there will be a Palestine state and an Israeli state. There'll be the two of them, and they will share Jerusalem, and we will have peace, but the Israelis don't want it, because what the Israelis want is the land. They want to take all the land. They don't want Gaza. They never wanted Gaza. That's why they were so happy to get rid of it and turn it into an open-air prison. But they want the West Bank. They want to chase out all the Muslims. They want to chase out all the Christians from the West Bank and take our land. And I'll tell you, even doesn't matter, Bethlehem, all those areas, whether it's a Muslim city or a Christian city, they want us gone. And I think that it's, I don't know, I admire Christians and Muslims who stand up and resist against Israel. I don't support the use of violence, but I'll tell you what, I don't think it's the Palestinians using violence, because in that war, the Palestinians, I think, killed a total of 9 Israelis. Excuse me, 6 of them were in military uniform, so they were in a war where they were expected possibly to be killed. Only 2 civilians or 3 civilians were killed during the war. And in contrast, 2,200 Muslim and Christian civilians were killed by the Israelis. So I don't know. Who is the bigger terrorist in the Middle East? It seems obvious to anybody that wants to be fair. Now, I get it. If you don't want to be fair, you don't want to recognize Palestinian rights, that's okay, but admit it. Tell the truth. Say that, you know what, I don't recognize Palestinian rights. Say it. I'm against peace. I think there should only be an Israeli state, and they have the right to kill anybody they want, including children. Go ahead, say it. But don't go out and say that you are a champion of civil rights when you say something like that. That's the Task Force on Palestine, an organization I respect a lot. I think they do a great job of representing the Palestinian cause and supporting the peace process. Because, you know what, I'm against injustice, but I support peace. I'm against injustice, and I'm against the use of violence. But I'm not just against the use of violence when it is convenient for me. I'm against the use of violence when it's used by both sides. That means the principled position, the person who really supports peace, is the person who not only condemns Palestinian terrorism and extremism and violence from that side, but also denounces Israeli terrorism and extremism, the settler terrorists, the government extremists. I mean, the racist, that Avigdor Lieberman, he's the foreign minister, saying that we should pay Christians and Muslims to leave the Holy Land. Can you imagine if that were said in the United States, how racist that is? Would you support that? Come on. Yet when Israel does it, we tend to close our ears and our eyes because we're afraid to speak out against Israel. We're afraid to speak out against Israel's government. And when you do criticize Israel's government, you know, they attack you, they call you anti-Semitic, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. The truth is that it's not anti-Semitic to criticize injustice. And that's what's happening in the Middle East today. Injustice. Israel is engaged in injustice. And one day, if the people don't speak out, who knows what terrible things are going to happen. And I blame them for making them happen. But if they were to stand up and speak out for peace, and if they were to say, let's condemn all extremism, let's condemn all violence by both sides, I could support that because that's exactly what I believe. Let's condemn violence on both sides. The UN resolution introduced by Jordan on behalf of the Palestinians would have done what Israel did in 1948. It would have made given recognition to Palestine as a sovereign state by the United Nations, even though it's under occupation by Israel's military, and even though Israel continues to commit war crimes and to steal land from Christians and Muslims in Palestine. And the resolution, what's interesting was that the Israelis and AIPAC, the lobbying organization that has the U.S. Congress in a headlock, were basically not allowed to have free speech when it comes to Israel, because if you do, AIPAC is in leadership of destroying your reputation and your career. They do terrible things. They say terrible things about people. And there are all kinds of organizations that do that, that defend Israel's injustices by using injustice to smear, libel, and attack people like myself and others who criticize Israel's government. Again, I'm not criticizing Israel. I'm criticizing their government. And I think that what the government is doing wrong. But what's fascinating is Israel complained that the UN resolution was a unilateral move. And yet Israel is the biggest violator of unilateral moves. Israel unilaterally takes land away from the Palestinians, and Israel unilaterally creates settlements only for their people, Christian and Muslims, that lose the land, and that land is then used only for people who happen to be Jewish and extremists too. They're fanatics. The settler movement is a terrorist organization. Unlike Hamas, which has been accused of being a terrorist group for many years, just recently was declared by the EU, the European Union, not to be a terrorist organization, because we all know that was more of a political description to kind of libel the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian grievances against Israel. So Mahmoud Abbas, the president of Palestine, has said that he will submit Palestine to the International Criminal Court, and they will become a member, and they'll pursue the International Criminal Court. It looks like we do have Ziad Asli, the executive director of the American Task Force on Palestine, on the line. Ziad, thank you so much for calling today. I so appreciate it.
Hi, Ray. Sorry I'm late. I just got stuck in somewhere. So how are you?
It wasn't an Israeli conspiracy, I hope, to keep you from coming on our radio show. Everything's a conspiracy. No. Listen, Ziad, let's cut to the chase, because your organization is probably one of the most effective and moderate. And when I say moderate, I mean reasonable. You approach the Middle East conflict from a very reasoned stand. I so support all of the initiatives and ideas and proposals, and we're a great admirer of one of your staff people over there, Hussein Ibish, who is a brilliant writer with the American Task Force on Palestine. But that's why we wanted to turn to you. I'm worried about the fact that the UN resolution failed and that Palestine has now applied for membership at the International Criminal Court. How do we find hope out of what happened?
Well, we had, first off, we had the collapse and failure of 9 months of negotiations last year. And then we had a war in Gaza right after that. So it was another major disappointment. And now the turn to the UN Security Council was problematic in the first place, because there were really not enough votes to support it, but the Palestinians tried anyway, and then there was a setback. Now, that means that the possibilities ranging from war to negotiations and turning to the International Legal community are diminishing and not yielding whatever, you know, aspirations the Palestinians have for a state. So clearly, it's an uphill fight. It's discouraging, I must say, but it is at the end of the day, every one of us has to keep in mind that creating a state of Palestine alongside Israel is the only solution.
Right.
All other possibilities are not solutions. They're options to continue the conflict through other means. So at some point in time, there will be a solution. No conflict goes unresolved forever. And for stability, you need to have a state of Palestine alongside Israel. So this has to be explored. The quest has to be carried on. And now, you know, going to the international organizations is potentially, you know, one way of advancing the cause on a legal front, but it is really a political fight. It's
right.
not a legal fight.
Now,
we have to.
Sorry, Ziad. Think it was a mistake to push ahead? Because what I've learned in politics is, and it's like Sun Tzu, you don't fight the war unless you know you're going to win. Shouldn't they have recognized that they weren't going to get the vote? You know, was it worth going down that road knowing? And I know they know. Does anybody believe that they thought they were going to win it? That the U.S., even if they had the votes, they would have vetoed it. But do you think it was a mistake doing what they did? Was there another way to do it?
Well, I think I have to say that this was not hard to read. The votes were not there, although claims were made that there were nine votes. Even if there were nine votes,
right.
you would still have to deal with the issue that the United States is opposed to it, and it would have to use its influence in order to make it not happen.
Right.
So the United States wanted to avoid a veto. Wisely so, because it would have been very embarrassing for the United States to veto
right.
the resolution that it's in theory in favor of a two-state solution. So this way, the United States was spared, saved from casting a veto, essentially by leaning on a couple of these
right.
countries.
Like Nigeria.
And making them abstain.
Yeah, like
yes.
Nigeria. I think you're right. I think from President Obama's position, he really does want to help the Palestinians, but he is walking a very difficult line that people think, oh, it should be easy, but it's not easy in politics. To stand up and really confront Israel is unheard of, you know, at the level that he's trying to do it. So I would have expected him to issue the veto whilst not undermining what I think is his fundamental belief that Palestinians do deserve a state. I think he's the one genuine person who really believes it, even more than Bill Clinton did when he was president.
I think it's safe to say that the policy of the United States is clearly in favor, supportive of establishing a state of Palestine alongside Israel. This is policy. This is formal policy.
Right.
It has been supported by the international community at large. The entire international community formed something called the Quartet, which is the U.S., Russia, Europe, and the United Nations. That's the whole world in support of a two-state solution. So it's international policy. What's tragic is that policy, in theory, supported by everyone, is not translated into practice by implementation on the ground. And here's you know, the real challenge is how do we bring the United States, Israel, and others, and the Palestinians, to a formulation that would be acceptable. Clearly, war is not an option anymore. We understand there is no military solution for this issue. So it has, once again, to be a political solution. And this is where, you know, traditional thinking is not going to be helpful. Traditional thinking is to divide this into a zero-sum game, the Palestinians on the one hand and the Israelis on the other, and then they go at it, and clearly it's a zero-sum game where the Palestinians are always going to end up with the zero because of the power imbalance. So we have to be more imaginative. Here's where crossing these these lines is going to be helpful from being Palestinians against Israelis to those in Palestine who want a solution against those in Palestine who do not want a solution. The same is in Israel. Those who want a solution in Israel have to link up with the Palestinians who want a solution, and this has to apply across the region. This kind of access formation is hard to do, and it exposes you to all kinds of criticism in your own community and others, but it is a way to rebridge what should have been bridged, you know, really, frankly, decades ago.
So we shouldn't.
But it's never too late.
We shouldn't take this then as the U.S. opposing that support of a Palestinian state. In other words, the fact that they weren't supporting the resolution doesn't mean that they don't continue to support Israel compromising and backing up. Correct?
Yeah, the United States officially is in favor of a two-state solution. The people of the United States, by every survey, the poll that you read, are in favor of a two-state solution. The majority of the Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans, as well as the majority of Palestinian Americans, are for two-state solutions. So all this has to be translated politically into a way that it is immune from the veto of those in Israel who object, and those in Palestine who object, and those in the United States who object. So we're talking about a political challenge here that has to be faced by the majority which is supporting the two-state solution still in the United States as we speak, even officially at the highest level of government too, is unable to politically make it happen. I think part of this is that a lot of the people in public who are present in public making their positions heard and known, etc., display entirely too much emotion, and it is usually to frustrate solutions rather than to find solutions.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. We're on the line with Ziad Asli. He's the executive director of the American Task Force on Palestine. The website is americantaskforce.org, and I urge you to go there because it is one of the most informative websites on the Palestine-Israel conflict to understand what the real issues are. Do you feel, Ziad, that we can get out of this, or, and maybe the question I should ask really focuses on American Arabs. Do we do enough to support, politicians to stand up and speak out against things that Israel does, that oftentimes they get away with because nobody holds them accountable, or is that not the issue? What do you think it is that we aren't doing enough of or we need to do more of? As American Arabs and Palestinians?
I think, by definition, we at the American Task Force in Palestine have a mission, and our mission is that we advocate for the creation of a state of Palestine alongside Israel as a national interest of the United States. We're speaking as Americans, defining our own national interest by saying two states is good for the United States. That solution is good for the United States. So in other words, we're using an American argument, which happens to be the truth, and which happens to apply to us, because we are, above all, we're American citizens who can and are able to participate in the political process. So for us not to be engaged in the political process and to leave it to others, or worse still, to say it's hopeless and we can't do anything about it, all that encourages the worst elements and keeps the status quo, which is a continued occupation.
Yeah, and do you think that it's where should the priority be? Should we be focused on, for example, like criticizing Israel for what it does against Palestinians, or should we try to focus more on reinforcing a growth in American attitudes toward the idea that an independent Palestinian state will be the foundation of peace in that region for the future?
Yeah, I actually do see the question as very valid and as very relevant. You know, it's enough. What we have done for decades is to be one against the other, Palestinians and Arabs against Israelis and Jews. This will lead to nowhere good. This will lead to more of the same. More of the same means no resolution, continued occupation. So we absolutely have to switch our own thinking. Part of this, we have to be working within the system to empower all the forces within the United States from across the spectrum, religion, race, economic divides, whatever, into those who support a two-state solution and hence can cross these bridges amongst each other, the divisive bridges, and translate that into political power to support the official policy of our country. It is a two-state solution. Now, I hear more voices recently, especially, you know, on people who have basically given up,
yeah,
given up on any solution that is related to politics. I understand the frustration. Clearly, it's frustrating for us because we've lived this disaster longer than the young people. But it, nevertheless, the fact that it's been long and hard does not mean that it is not achievable. Simply, at some point in time, the politics of Israel itself will change to say, do we want a state for ourselves, or do we want the Palestinians to share with us in that state? My own guess is that the Israelis have wanted a state for themselves. But if they end up with one state, like what's being advocated by them, it will not be a Jewish state, which is what they want. Well, then the problem is the Arabs of Israel and the Palestinians who are not yet part of Israel but are occupied by Israel are already 50% of the population. They cannot be disenfranchised forever. The one state that people are talking about, we have it already. It's called Israel. The state of Israel is a one state that rules over everybody in that region, and the citizens of Israel are enfranchised, while the citizens of Palestine, who that does not exist, are disenfranchised. And they are disenfranchised within Israeli law. It doesn't apply to them. They have no rights that are similar to the citizens of Israel. So it is an Israeli necessity as much as it is a Palestinian necessity to separate these two people.
Any final thoughts from you, Ziad, on what is happening?
What's happening is discouraging, and people should not rejoice that everything is failing. It's not good. If you visit Palestine often and see how people live, you understand perfectly that the status quo is something that keeps getting worse all the time. It keeps getting worse. It's not something stable. And this will lead to further confrontations if no political framework is adopted and implemented. Hence, the effort on this level in this country to not just impact decision-making, to translate decisions into implementation. The decisions have been made, but make it implementable. Giving up on a state of Palestine denies the Palestinians the chance to be first-class citizens in one place on earth. One place on earth where the Palestinians can be first-class citizens is Palestine.
Okay.
Except for the United States, actually. Funnily, the Palestinians have more rights in the United States than anywhere else in the world.
All right.
Palestinian Americans, that is.
Israel, as Israelis, should they vote and become engaged in the Israeli election in March? I think it's March 17th.
Should they get involved? Completely. Quick answer. Definitely, 100%. They have to be enfranchised, and they have to generate enough political support to come up with a solution.
All right.
Otherwise, the people who oppose the solution will be in the majority.
You're good. Listen, Ziad, you're so generous to share your time with us. I would love to bring you back on again just to talk more about this when it's convenient. Thank you so much for joining us. Ziad Asli, Executive Director.
Thank you, Ray.
You're welcome. Of the American Task Force on Palestine, that is americantaskforce.org. I'm Ray Hanania here at Talk of the Town, Yahala Voice, 1450 AM radio. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with another guest who we lined up, Stanley Cohen, who is the attorney for a lot of people who have been accused of terrorism. He's an American Jewish attorney who believes that everybody has a right to defend themselves, especially if they're just suspects and they're in custody. I'm Ray Hanania. We'll be right back right after these messages.
الإذاعة العربية في شيكاغو.
يتم الآن عرض للفن الإسلامي التشكيلي بكامل جماله وغناه في شيكاغو. The Art Institute of Chicago يحتضن معرض كامل للاستمتاع بفنون التخطيط، الهندسة، السيراميك والفن التشكيلي الموجود منذ آلاف السنين في جميع أنحاء العالم الإسلامي. لا تضيع الفرصة لمشاهدة أجمل أعمال الفن الإسلامي.
هوم لايف فيرنيتشر، آخر صيحات الأثاث وكل ما تحتاج من مفروشات. هوم لايف فيرنيتشر، الأمانة، الأخوة والدقة في المواعيد.
No credit needed to finance. Everyone is approved at Home Life Furniture, 13449 South Cicero Avenue in Crestwood, Illinois, 708-631-3627. Mention Yahala Voice and your delivery is free. Get $200 off when you spend $1,500.
You have a medical alert device. When you press the button for help, can you talk through your pendant? With many companies, you still have to talk through the base unit, and that's not much help in an emergency. The answer, LifeRun Medical Alert Systems. Simply press the button and talk to a live operator right through the pendant. If your device can't do that, upgrade to LifeRun today. The system is free, the shipping is free, and the monitoring fee is less than a dollar a day. Call LifeRun now at 1-800-421-3366 or order online at LifeRun.com.
Man Carry Chrysler Jeep Dodge's 72-hour sale starts now. $30 million in inventory, $5 million in discounts, and $25 million to lend will be available for this public sale at Man Carry's Chrysler Jeep Dodge at Oak Lawn. Now through Monday, get $12,000 off MSRP. Get 0% for 72 months, plus a $4,500 rebate. 800 factory cars are on display. Brand new Jeep Cherokees, Grand Cherokees, minivans, Ram trucks, and more. $5 million in discounts will be made available on Man Carry's $30 million of new car inventory. Stop what you're doing right now and get to Man Carries at Oak Lawn. $12,000 off MSRP. 0% for 72 months, plus $4,500 in rebates. $30 million in inventory and bank reps on site with $25 million to lend. You will drive today. Hurry. This public sale will absolutely end Monday. Sale hours extended till midnight at Man Carry Chrysler Jeep Dodge on 95th Street, Oak Lawn.
On select models, $1,389 per thousand with zero down with approved credit plus tax, title, license, and doctor.
منتجات زياد من عائلتنا إلى عائلتكم. أفضل المنتجات الغذائية نوفرها لموائدكم. متطلبات المطبخ العربي نقدمها لكم من خلال ماركاتنا السلطان، كرافت، نستلي، بوك، ريفل بيكان، دانا. ستجدونها في كافة المحلات والبقاليات. للمزيد من المعلومات زوروا موقعنا زياد.com. منتجات زياد من عائلتنا إلى عائلتكم.
What's going on, everybody? I'm Rush, here to tell you about the best talk show on the planet. It's called Rise Up. If you're looking for a show that talks about all the issues that matter to you, then you need to listen to Rise Up. From the latest stories happening back home in Palestine, the Middle East, and of course all the stories happening in our own backyard in Chicago, and of course across the nation. That is what Rise Up is all about. Plus, Rise Up is a program that wants to hear from you. Call the show, 708-321-1313, extension 1. Oh, by the way, I also do this show with this guy named Bob. We call him the Great American. The guy thinks he's an expert when it comes to Arab-related news. Actually, he's not so bad. So listen to Rise Up every Wednesday, 4:30 to 6 p.m. Central Time on Chicago's 1450 AM and YahalaVoice.com.
علي صوتك مع صوت يهلا.
And welcome back to Talk of the Town Radio. I'm Ray Hanania here at 1450 AM in Chicago and broadcast internationally online at YahalaVoice.com. Right now I want to switch gears and talk with somebody that I really admire. He's a New York civil rights attorney. And I'll tell you what, some people talk about civil rights. This guy lives civil rights. His name is Stanley Cohen. Now he doesn't just represent, people that, everyday people that are accused of crimes. He represents some of the toughest, criminal cases where accusations are made. And in many cases, people are considered guilty until proven innocent, especially if they happen to be Arab from the Middle East and if they're accused of terrorism. A lot of Stanley Cohen's clients have been accused of terrorism or have been accused of being affiliated with terrorists, and his ability to stand up and defend them has so thwarted the United States that recently they went after him and they targeted him, and he was convicted of, and I think there was an 18-month jail sentence that he's going to start on Tuesday. So this will be our last time to talk to him until we can help get him out. And I want to welcome Stanley Cohen to our radio show. Stanley, thank you so much for taking your few moments of freedom to talk to us here at Talk of the Town Radio.
Oh, thank you, Ray. But, you know, it's not anecdotal, but they can put me behind bars. It won't take my freedom.
Yeah, I admire the way you stand up, and so many people, listen, when you're Arab and you criticize Israel, we get attacked. You're Jewish, and it's not a criticism of Israel, it's a criticism of their policies, and you've been called some of the worst things in the book. How do you deal with that?
Well, a lot of people talk about truth, and a lot of people talk about justice. And a lot of people talk about equality. And there are many people that even do things about it around the safe issues. I mean, fighting to combat homelessness or hunger or infant mortality are all critically important, but they're easy. There's no intense debate or discussion. There's no enormous lobbying machine that owns the government, such as AIPAC. When it comes to Israel, when it comes to the Middle East, when it comes to U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, it forces people to challenge the cornerstones, the foundations of this government, of its reliance upon a system of surrogate states in the Middle East, including fundamentally Israel, of course, and Egypt and Jordan, and in the Gulf. They serve as surrogates. They target people. They have black holes that are prisons. They torture people. They rendition people at the behest of the United States. So that now Obama, who, as you know, I call "I have a drone." I think I've just used his name for the first time in public for years. Relies upon this policy of drones, of assassinations, of the slaughter of thousands of civilians.
Go ahead. Sorry. Finish it.
I was going to say, when it comes to core issues, people back away. They get intimidated. They get frightened. They're
right.
Afraid the government's going to come for them. They're afraid what happened to Stanley Cohen can happen to them. It's true, but you have to make a decision about who you are, what you believe in, and what you're willing to do with your life.
The hardest thing in the world, I think, is to stand up for what's right. In other words, it's not just a matter of whether a person is guilty or not guilty. It's a matter of ensuring that they're judged fairly, that the rule of law, which we as a country, we supposedly believe in, that everybody has a right to defend themselves. I admire attorneys who stand up and defend the toughest clients, the people where PR is so negative that the retribution and anger is focused not just at them, but it gets focused at somebody like you. How does it make you feel when you hear people who say, "I support freedom, I support you know, the rule of law, and then turn around with people that they hate and want to deny that to them. It just seems there's something wrong with that.
Well, again, it goes back to, as I just said, Ray, that, you know, due process and justice is fine for a drug case. Due process and justice is fine for a burglary case. Due process and justice is fine for, you know, a sex abuse case of some sort. But when it comes to, you know, the so-called war on terrorism, which is a fancy way of saying the U.S. attack on people from the Middle East, on Islamophobia, on Arabs, on people from South Asia, when it comes to people that are accused of engaging in what would otherwise be protected speech, protected activity and association, the rule of law goes out the window. At that point, especially since 9/11, you know, since 9/11, the boogeyman in our country has been terrorism. We have these joint terrorist task force that are self-creating. They produce enormous funds for local police departments. We see what happens with the militarization of police departments nationwide. We see, I've probably done more real and fake so-called terrorism cases than any lawyer in the country since the mid-1990s. And I can tell you the vast majority of them are concocted cases in which they identify Arabs, particularly young Arab men, particularly Palestinians, particularly people who have the audacity, in quotes, to speak up, to speak out, to take a stand. Increasingly, the prosecution under the Obama administration has become consumed with political persecutions and not prosecutions, with a surveillance network and a surveillance state, with targeting journalists, with targeting activists, and with targeting lawyers who dare to stand up and challenge its myopic view of the universe, in which the United States and Israel and a system of surrogate states create so much mayhem and so much distrust and so much problems throughout the world.
You know what? I think it is so contradictory for how we view Obama, and it's kind of disconcerting, because here is an African American who probably was, you know, the beneficiary of civil rights at a time when blacks were persecuted just because they were black. I mean, someone who should know this more than anybody is not as supportive of the civil rights. Is he playing politics with all this to achieve a good goal, or is he just simply doing something wrong?
He's the penultimate bean counter. Obama goes left, goes right, crosses the street, sits on the fence, only after he counts how many votes he garners by a particular position.
Wow.
But you've got to keep in mind that Obama, you show me someone his age who was not, and is African American, who was not involved in the struggle against apartheid, as he was not. There's nothing that indicates that he played any role in the civil rights movement. There's nothing that indicates that he's done anything when it comes to core values of the Constitution, except the finely tuned and sold resume.
And basically be a beneficiary. He's basically a beneficiary of it, really, than an advocate.
Oh, absolutely. Under this administration, there are more people of color in prison for violentless, for nonviolent or complaintless crimes than in any administration in history. Under this administration, more people of color have been murdered by police departments across this country than any other one. Under this administration, more civilians have been targeted, for example, in the Middle East through drone attacks and through assassinations than just about any other one, including the Bush administration.
Wow.
So this is an administration that has packed itself with African Americans. This is an administration that talks when it comes to civil rights, but when it comes to fundamental civil rights, it not only does nothing about it, but it does quite the opposite. Perhaps no better example than its blind and dead support for the Israeli killing machine, which is paid for largely and has been for years by the United States and has recently gotten a big boost by the Obama administration.
Now, you and I are from the same generation. We're the exact same age, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up at a time during the Vietnam War. I don't know whether you protested it or not. I did, but I ended up having to serve 2 years. The big issue at the time was the use of torture against our soldiers, how we condemned it, we criticized it, we attacked it, And yet today, so many Americans seem to be saying, no, it's okay to use torture. Torture is okay against those people. What's going to happen to our people if we get into the next war and we're taken prisoner? It scares me. It frightens me how our prisoners are going to be treated. You know, our Americans will be treated as prisoners in another country because of the new standard that we've set.
Well, nothing speaks to that more loudly than the recent example of Abdulrahman Qasig, the American hostage, the aid worker, who was thrown under the bus by this administration and ended up being beheaded by Daesh across overseas because this administration made a conscious decision to do certain things or not do certain things, knowing full well that an American would be beheaded and also knowing full well that it would set back a whole attempt to try to build a bridge so that these types of activities would become less possible in the future. This is an administration that does not think about long-term consequences, but rather thinks about short-term rhetoric and short-term militarism. And that's what they've been heavily involved in for 6 years now.
Now, you were involved, I understand, to try and free Qasig. Was that correct?
Yeah, there's a very large, long story in The Guardian about it. I was approached by some Palestinians who had worked with Qasig in Sabra Shatila or another camp in Lebanon. They were very concerned because he had been scheduled to be the next to be beheaded. And then I also heard from a member of Veterans for Peace at the same time who was very concerned because the administration wasn't doing anything with regard to him at all. I did some research. I took a look at Mr. Qasig's background. I was moved by his history. I was moved by his words. I was moved by his activities of humanitarian work in a short period of time. So I reached out to some, the irony, I reached out to some ex-Gitmo detainees, some men who, and one in particular initially, someone who had been tortured by the United States in Bagram and Kandahar and spent 6.5 years in Gitmo. And this gentleman and some of his friends and other Gitmo veterans, for lack of a better word, in Kuwait, along with people in Jordan, folks who also had been incarcerated and tortured by surrogate states of the United States, along with myself, did what we could quietly over a six-week period to save Abdulrahman Qasig's life. We were on the right track. There had been no beheadings for 6 weeks. There were discussions underway. We had set up a protocol for direct communications between one of the most influential imams in the world and one of his former students, who's the Grand Mufti of ISIS. And those discussions were underway. The discussions had the blessing of Jordan. The discussions had the blessing of the United States. They were reduced to writing. They were negotiated. The talks began, we started making significant progress, and then Jordan arrested the imam, basically not just killing the talks, but not long thereafter, resulting in the beheading of Abdulrahman Qasig, as well as the breakdown of communications that we were building in terms of a bridge in the region.
Was it because Jordan saw an opportunity to benefit itself and not care about this guy, Qasig, or...
there's two different theories that I've sort of moved back and forth. My initial theory was that when you're a surrogate state of the United States and you're paid billions of dollars, you can't, in terms of your own economic self-interest and your own geopolitical agenda, you can't sit back while non-state actors are able to accomplish what you as a funded surrogate state cannot. For example, the group that I was working with in the Middle East for 6 weeks, 6 months earlier had arranged, facilitated the release of 36 UN peacekeepers and an American. So my initial theory was as much that states like Jordan and Egypt and Kuwait and Saudi and other states in the region that are very much surrogates could not afford to have a repeat where non-state actors, particularly those affiliated with Al-Qaeda at one time, particularly groups that are affiliated or individuals with fighters, could not allow them to accomplish what they could not because it would hurt them economically and politically. There came a time when I began to move in a little different circle, the more that I saw about it, because when Sheikh Mukisi was arrested, I reached out again to the government and insisted, begged them, implored them to just simply call Abdullah and tell him to release him so that the talks could continue. And they refused. They didn't do it. And they said, we're not going down there.
And they knew that. And they knew the consequences that would happen.
Well, then they floated this ridiculous, it's pure rubbish. They floated this ridiculous idea that the reason why they wanted, that they didn't take a stronger position was they were afraid of a real rapprochement between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Absolutely zero chance of that happening. In fact, the two imams that were involved in negotiations and discussions with ISIS are on the front cover of a magazine put out by Daesh this month in a very poor light. There was zero chance of what the government would like people to believe of a so-called tsunami of terrorism arising where Daesh and Nasra and Al-Qaeda would merge to become one fighting force. It wasn't going to happen. And that's why I say the Obama administration didn't hold the knife, but certainly was responsible for the murder of Mr. Kasich.
Stanley, we're almost out of time on the show, but I got to tell you that your story is compelling. I know that you're going to have to turn yourself in on Tuesday. It's a tax evasion charge. I want to let everybody know.
It's not actually a tax evasion. That's a distortion the government's put out there.
That's what I mean. They've accused you of that, and it sounds almost as if they targeted you politically. But I want my listeners to know that your website is istanleycohen.org. There's a petition there to support him, to have him pardoned, because it's ridiculous. He's being targeted for political reasons, and there's no way for me to believe that these charges are legitimate, given what he's done on behalf of civil rights and constitutional law. Stanley, I hope everything goes well. I wish you the best. I wish we could get you on again, you know, to talk some more about this, but I do appreciate you spending some of your last free moments of freedom here, and I hope things work out for you. Thank you.
Thank you so very much for having me, and for your listeners, I really do send my love and respect and appreciate all their support. Not to worry, I'll go to jail, I'll come out, I'll continue fighting.
All right, istanleycohen.org is the website, istanleycohen.org. Stanley Cohen's my guest, civil rights and constitutional attorney. Thank you so much, Stanley.
Thank you. Take care, Ray.
And best wishes. Good luck. That's enough here at Talk of the Town Radio. We're right at the end of the deadline. Stay tuned for some more great programs, and we will talk to you next Friday at 4:05. Have a great week. Bye-bye, everybody.
يا هلا فويس صوتك العربي.